Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, media present the cap-and-trade legislation currently being debated in the U.S. Senate as the green alternative to the voluntary approaches of pro-industry types. But does cap-and-trade work at reducing global warming-causing emissions, and is it the only alternative? We'll talk to Michael Dorsey, professor of global environmental policy at Dartmouth College. Also on Counterspin today, Al Jazeera English has found it nearly impossible to crack the U.S. television market, with only two or three cable providers willing to offer the news channel to their subscribers. Now one of those companies, Burlington Telecom in Vermont, might be pulling the plug. We'll talk to Ken Picard, a reporter with 7 Days newspaper who's been covering the issue. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Former Bush press secretary Scott McClellan's new book, What Happened, has received a chilly reception from the White House and GOP partisans. And because McClellan describes journalists as deferential, complicit enablers of the White House's case for the Iraq War, they aren't exactly welcoming the book warmly either. ABC World News anchor Charles Gibson was just one of many who protested McClellan's description. Quote, I think the questions were asked. You know, you go back to the Powell speech, there was a lot of skepticism raised about that. I can remember getting in trouble with administration officials because asking questions that they didn't feel comfortable with, close quote. CNN anchor Wolf Blitzer was another, quote, I think we were pretty strong. Certainly we raised the important questions, close quote. Well, as Fair pointed out at the time, Colin Powell's UN speech was nearly universally fawned over by a media that, among other things, ignored AP reporter Charles Hanley's reports, finding that the Iraqi sites named as suspicious by Powell and other White House officials had all been safely sealed since inspections in the early 1990s. As for featuring anti-war voices, a Fair study at the time of Powell's address found that of the 393 sources appearing in network TV Iraq stories, only 3, or less than 1%, were identified with organized protests or anti-war groups. This at a time that nearly 30% of Americans opposed the war outright, and 60% thought more time should be given to inspections and diplomacy. The Bush administration's hostile reaction to McClellan's book is to be expected, but the reaction from many in the elite media demonstrates that the White House is not the only institution that resents being held accountable.
With Barack Obama and John McCain all set for the general election campaign, the Washington Post noted on May 30th that the Iraq War could be a salient issue and one where the candidates would seem to have clearly divergent positions. But the paper argued that the issue is more complicated than you might think. Quote, new public opinion polling suggests the war is more a wild card than a slam dunk for either side. While voters still see the invasion of Iraq as a mistake, they are divided about the current course of the war and where to go from here. McCain continues to be favored as the candidate most trusted on the issue, albeit with a statistically insignificant edge. But most Americans favor Obama's central position, withdrawing combat forces, close quote. This is a tendentious reading of public opinion on Iraq. The public is divided, but polls show it's mostly between those who favor rapid withdrawal versus a slower reduction of U.S. troops. When polls offer a choice between keeping the same number of troops in Iraq or withdrawing them, the latter is the overwhelming preference. The same anti-war tilt holds when the choice is between ending the war in the next year or two or fighting as long as necessary, as the New York Times poll asked in April. The fact that some surveys show the public gives McCain an advantage over Obama on the handling of the Iraq War suggests that voters might not have a clear idea of McCain's actual position. Media coverage that muddies up the debate certainly doesn't help.
When you see the headline, Is Walmart Too Liberal?, you might assume you're reading a satirical news outlet like The Onion. Alas, the headline in question did really appear in the June 9th Newsweek, and it wasn't a joke, or at least it wasn't supposed to be. Somehow, the anti-union retail giant famous for squeezing suppliers and pricing independent competitors out of business is actually, as the piece's subhead explained, quote, being criticized for bowing to political correctness, close quote. What's really happening here is a staple of lazy journalism, the man-bites-dog story, which grants attention to some event simply because it cuts against what you might think you know about the world. In this case, it's a lonely right-wing activist who has been, quote, lambasting Walmart for being too nice to unions, too concerned about the environment, and too accommodating to gays and lesbians, close quote. His case is, to say the least, hard to swallow, but Newsweek grants the right-wing activist space to make his case that Walmart should, for example, stop selling organic food. Why this qualifies as something you'd give much space in a news magazine is just as hard to figure out, but the point is that conservatives are attacking Walmart, too. The magazine notes in passing that Walmart is accustomed to hearing run-of-the-mill liberal criticisms that hit every large company. Why bother with that boring old stuff when you can highlight the opposite, that corporate America is apparently too kind and too green?
Columnist and TV talking head George Will has long been a climate change denier, and he shows little sign he's ready to give up. In a June 1st op-ed in the Washington Post, Will criticized Republican John McCain for apparently being too concerned with this non-issue. Will pointed out that even the UN's World Meteorological Organization, quote, says global temperatures have not risen in a decade, close quote. Now, that would seem a little odd. One of the premier monitors of global temperature doesn't seem to think warming is much of a problem anymore. Well, Will has actually made this claim before, so it's worth tracing its origin. It seemed to start with a misleading account of a recent UN report on the BBC, which in turn made it to radio talk show host Rush Limbaugh, whose summary of the story was similar to Will's point, namely that the last 10 years challenged the very existence of global warming. The problem, as pointed out by climate researchers and the D-Smog climate blog, is that the World Meteorological Association didn't say anything like this. The group noted on April 4th that, quote, the long-term upward trend of global warming, mostly driven by greenhouse gas emissions, is continuing. Global temperatures in 2008 are expected to be above the long-term average. The decade from 1998 to 2007 has been the warmest on record, close quote. And this global warming ended in 1998 trick has been around for some time. It relies on cherry-picking an unusually hot year as the starting point, which makes subsequent years seem relatively cool. So the real questions here are simple. Does George Will get his science tips from Rush Limbaugh, and does the Washington Post fact-check his columns?
And finally, USA Today publisher Craig Moon described his newspaper's priorities in a June 2nd interview with Ad Age when he said, quote, as committed as we are to covering American foreign policy, we're also deeply committed to covering American Idol, close quote. This could only shock the naive. More clear-eyed observers are more likely to see it as obvious. After all, as Ad Age points out, this is the newspaper that shortly after its launch in 1982 led with the death of the inconsequential Princess Grace, rather than the political assassination of Lebanon's newly elected president, Bashir Gemayel. Its tendency toward shallow, short, and sensational articles earned USA Today the nickname McPaper. The main point of the Ad Age piece is that USA Today is considered a successful model for newspapers. With local papers floundering because of the loss of classified ad revenues, USA Today, a splashy national paper that never ran classifieds, soldiers on. That angle is clearly presented when Ad Age asked, quote, whether the paper gloated about getting so much right so early, close quote. Well, that depends on how you define success. If profit is the measure of a good newspaper, then USA Today is among the most successful. But the truth is, most newspapers still turn a profit. It's only by modern Wall Street standards that newspapers are considered failing if they don't return 20% on investment. However, measuring success by another standard, one that, say, values journalism, public service, and a newspaper's role in a democracy, would yield a very different assessment of USA Today.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch group Fair. Fair also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show. The U.S. Senate is debating cap-and-trade legislation that supporters say would help to reduce global warming. Under a cap-and-trade system, the government gives companies allowances, permitting them to emit a level of global warming-causing greenhouse gases based on their past emissions, but set at lower levels than in the past. Companies can then cut their emission levels and sell their allowances to less efficient companies, or buy allowances from more efficient companies in order to continue emitting a higher level of greenhouse gases. The companies can also buy extra allowances. Cap and trade is usually presented in media debates as the green position on global warming, opposite the voluntary approach favored by pro-industry voices. But are cap and trade policies effective in reducing emissions, and are they the only alternative? Joining us now is Michael Dorsey, professor of global environmental policy at Dartmouth College and author of Green Market Hustlers, published online by Foreign Policy in Focus. He also penned the Los Angeles Times op-ed, Carbon Trading Won't Work, in April of 2007. Michael Dorsey, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Steve, thanks for having me on.
Well, you're a critic of cap-and-trade approaches. Tell us, what's wrong with cap-and-trade?
Well, maybe I should explain cap-and-trade first. Cap-and-trade works this way. A group of nations, say, for example, the signatories of the Kyoto Protocol, or a group of states like the New England states or the Western states that are currently coming together under Governor Schwarzenegger's plan, they would cap their carbon emissions at a certain level. Then a government agency, in the case of Europe, maybe the European Union, or in the case of the Western states, maybe the California EPA, would issue permits to polluting industries. In this case, they'd be polluting greenhouse gases or carbon dioxide. And those agencies would tell the countries or the states how much carbon dioxide they would be allowed to emit over a certain time. Companies that are unable to stay under the cap, under the limit, can decide to buy permits, or what are sometimes called emissions credits or allowances, on a trading exchange, which would allow them to pollute more, or they would face heavy fines if they didn't purchase those credits or allowances. Firms that are able to come in under the caps would have some surplus allowances or credits, which they could sell on the various exchanges. And so, and essentially, what we have is the right to pollute becomes a commodity that's bought and sold in a marketplace.
But isn't there an incentive there to reduce emissions?
Well, that's how you would hope it would work. One of the things that we have to keep in mind is that the sort of the idea of trading pollution rights was sort of put forward for the first time in the United States when the Clean Air Act was reauthorized in 1990. That program successfully reduced the amount of sulfur dioxide emissions, which was the sort of the leading character in driving acid rain. And that program worked in part because there were a few sources that were driving the acid rain problem, about 3,000-odd smokestacks, primarily in the Midwest. Those sources could be effectively monitored. There was controls to track their emissions and actually track them pretty much in real time, and that program's still going on, and we can see that. The problem is that when you scale up a cap-and-trade program to the global scale, you run into issues over monitoring, you run into issues over who's tracking the polluters and how much integrity do we have over that data and that information. And the fact is, right now, we don't have that information. So to scale up a cap-and-trade program on a global scale to attempt to deal with greenhouse gases is just non-viable. And pretty much the sort of science on this has been known for a long time, and the critics have been there, but it just so happens that a handful of industry-interested folks that mainly are coming from those that are driving the greenhouse problem in the first place, they're trying to push this sort of line of thinking forward, and they're doing so right now in the current legislation, sort of the leading climate change bills that are being negotiated on Capitol Hill, like the Werner-Lieberman bill. And they're pushing this forward, but really what we've seen in the largest formally online regulated cap-and-trade system, which exists in Europe. That's the biggest formally regulated one. What we haven't seen since it's been on the past few years, we haven't seen greenhouse gases decline. They've actually increased. The number of lawsuits by both firms that are participating in the process in Europe, as well as the countries that control the allocation of the credits or the allowances. There's lawsuits back and forth. There's lots of bickering over the system. And the fact is that right now, given all of the known science, we have to reduce greenhouse gases as quickly as humanly possible. And if we don't do so, we run the risk of driving a climate catastrophe. And so that right now the cap and trade system, it's not designed to work quickly enough. It won't work quickly enough. It's not been working quickly enough in Europe. And it won't work quickly enough in the United States.
What would you support?
Well, right now we need to take some really strong and fast, hard measures to reduce CO2 in the atmosphere. And that process will probably have to be driven by strong taxes on emitters. That process is also going to have to be driven by huge government infusions of capital to drive new technologies. That process is also going to have to be driven by recommitting the next administration that comes to the White House to getting serious at the global negotiating table, where the sort of global collective responses to climate change are being proposed within the negotiations around the climate change treaty, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. So there's sort of three things, putting caps and bringing polluters under control by targeting them and increasing the cost of emissions, driving monies that come out of that process, that taxation process on the large emitters, driving that into technological developments, which could bootstrap other industries. So it's not like we're just penalizing industries and then windfalls are created and those monies go nowhere. We need to take those monies that we get from the large polluters, drive that into alternative energy technologies and push those technologies, and then also get serious at the international negotiating table.
Now, you've just named a number of policies that aren't really central to the debate that's going on right now. And let me see if I can describe part of that problem. An April 20th Washington Post report says cap-and-trade policy is, quote, favored by many environmentalists, close quote. One of the complicating factors in how cap-and-trade is presented as the green position in the media is that many establishment environmental groups do support it. Why would they support a green policy that wasn't all that green?
Well, you know, it's always been curious to me as well, you know, why large environmental groups like Environmental Defense, like Natural Resources Defense Council, and even one of whose board I used to sit on, the Sierra Club, are backing these sort of ludicrous cap-and-trade policies. I think you probably have to get some of those folks on your show and ask them yourself, because the fact is that market participants, market makers like George Soros, folks at Goldman Sachs, folks at a whole long list of investment banks, they actually are very, very skeptical of the efficacy of cap-and-trade programs to reduce greenhouse gases. George Soros said just last year in late fall of 2007 that he didn't believe that cap-and-trade programs would actually reduce greenhouse gases. And he said so. Why? Because he said, I'm a market participant. I know how markets work. I know what they can and they cannot do. And I don't think that they're going to play a role, a significant role, in reducing greenhouse gases, because that's what markets are not designed to do. So I think really the reasoning of some of the large environmental groups is out of sync with the realities of Wall Street, with the realities of the FTSE in London and the various markets, because the market participants there are very, very skeptical of these types of practices.
The policies that you suggested are, as I said, are somewhat marginalized in the media debate. But are there any really good media sources you would direct listeners to on the subject of cap and trade and related issues?
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the best places, maybe starting in the U.S., you know, the work of reporters like Ross Gelbspan, who was formerly at the Boston Globe and now is, he's writing books and he's, constantly, having articles on this issue in a variety of news sources. Ross Gelbspan is doing sharp analysis of how cap and trade is not going to be a solution for climate change. Globally, the places to look toward is the Financial Times, the London international newspaper. And there we've seen probably the best coverage of why this project of cap and trade isn't working in Europe and is a bad sort of project for the United States. They've done tons of exposés, tons of detailed ongoing investigations of fraudulent firms, of the beleaguered process of the European Union Emissions Trading Scheme, which is the formal regulated system that is up and running in Europe. The Financial Times has gone to great lengths, some great reporting by reporters like Fiona Harvey and others there at the FT.
We've been speaking with Michael Dorsey, professor of global environmental policy at Dartmouth College. His forthcoming book on climate justice will be published in 2009. You can read his piece, Green Market Hustlers, online at the Foreign Policy in Focus website at www.fpif.org. Michael Dorsey, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
It's a pleasure.
No matter how many new channels your local cable company adds to its menu, there never seems to be room for certain types of programming. You might like to see what they're doing at Al Jazeera English, for example, but don't bet on your cable provider giving you that chance anytime soon. The channel is apparently available on just two or three cable systems in the United States, and it might lose one of them very soon. Burlington Telecom in Vermont is embroiled in a dispute over whether to keep the channel, which critics accuse of being nothing more than an English-language version of the Pan-Arabic channel of the same name. Ken Picard has been covering this story for the past month. He's a staff reporter for 7 Days newspaper in Vermont, and he joins us now by phone. Ken Picard, welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you so much. So good to be here.
Well, let's walk this back to the beginning. About a month ago, the GM at Burlington Telecom says they're going to drop the channel, but the rationale is a little unclear. What was the reason or the couple of reasons they gave you for their decision?
Well, initially, the general manager, Chris Burns, had told me that the reason they wanted to drop Al Jazeera was that they had received, quote-unquote, dozens of complaints from subscribers of Burlington Telecom. Now, it should be, I should make it clear to your listeners that Burlington Telecom is a municipal cable service, so it's owned by the city of Burlington. This is not a private company. He had told me that initially that he was getting all these complaints from the public. Subsequently, it sounds like he was backpedaling on that explanation. When he later was called on that, he issued a written statement saying that the justification was that they didn't have a signed contract with Al Jazeera, and there were certain liability issues that had arisen.
Now, the municipality angle is, or the municipality ownership of BT is kind of what makes this interesting, because the channel can't just drop a channel. It seems that there is a process that has to go on. What's been happening with that?
Well, this one's kind of interesting because Burlington Telecom, just for a little bit of history, Burlington Telecom's been around since January of 2002 and was founded as sort of a very unique model. The idea was to bring a fiber optic network to the home for telephone and internet and cable television service. So what happened was apparently sometime in December of 2006, an employee at Burlington Telecom, who's no longer there, made a decision to pick up Al Jazeera English, in part because the network was free, and as many of your listeners probably know, fiber optic gives you an almost unlimited option for number of channels. You can probably get 100,000 channels. So somebody began to notice that Al Jazeera was on the air, and some of the complaints started coming in. And so general manager Chris Burns made a decision to essentially pull it off, and hoping that maybe nobody would notice.
Is the opposition organized in any way?
Well, there's no one particular group that's been involved with it. I found out about this initially from a group called the Israel Center of Vermont, and as the name suggests, they are a group that is very pro-Israel, made up of a lot of prominent members of the Jewish community in the Burlington area. They, in many ways, try to keep track of the portrayals of Jews and Israel in the media, and sometime in April, they sent out a email notice to all their members, letting them know that it had come to their attention that the English language version of Al Jazeera was on the air, and they basically slammed it and urged their members to write to Chris Burns asking Burlington Telecom to pull it off the air.
I saw a reference to another group called the Defenders Council of Vermont. So clearly, there's something going on. It's moved into this second phase, I guess, where there's this advisory committee that meets to hear this, and I think another committee closer to city government. Where do things stand right now? Does it look likely or less likely that this station will be pulled?
Well, I think what's going on right now is, I think there's two issues going on here. I mean, certainly the first one is whether or not Al Jazeera should be is something that should be offered to Burlington Telecom subscribers. And I think the second issue is what the process is to make that determination. At this point right now, there are two citizen advisory committees, one of which is required by the state for any kind of cable company. They, since they had never weighed in on the decision, I think what they want to do now is hold some hearings, and next Wednesday they will be holding some public hearings to get feedback from the community. Now, if the public comment runs anything similar to a similar meeting that was held last week, which I would say it was about 5-1 in favor of keeping Al Jazeera on the air, my guess is that they will probably go that way. But, you know, at this point it's hard to say. Thus far there's been, I think some of the folks in the opposition haven't been heard from yet. There's now a resolution in city council to weigh some of the financial ramifications of either pulling it off the air or keeping it on the air. So, you know, clearly, I think both sides are lining up to see which direction this is going to go. But my guess is I don't think any decision is going to be made anytime soon. And it remains to be seen whether or not this will stay on the air.
So it sounds like stay tuned is the message. Well, we've been speaking with Ken Picard. He's a staff reporter at 7 Days newspaper in Vermont. You can follow his reporting on this story at 7DVT.com, or you can find the link at FAIR's website. Ken Picard, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the media watch group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bimonthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure to tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. If you subscribe now, your subscription will begin with the June issue of Extra. That includes a cover story on McCain, the media's maverick, by Counterspin's own Peter Hart. Also, a study of the media's coverage of the election, a look at what's on the nightly newscast about the election, and a look at sexism in the primary coverage. You'll also get a review of the media's shamefully gushing eulogies to William F. Buckley, and a look at the history and coverage of waterboarding. All that and much more in the June issue of Extra. If you missed part of today's show or would like to listen to past Counterspin shows, you can do that at FAIR's website at www.fair.org. And while you're there, you can also sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. This show was engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.